We will call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. We have a lot of things to get through today. I don't think we have a quorum at this point, but hopefully we will soon. I've been putting off one of my duties now for some time, and it looks like I might have to put it off a little bit longer. At some point, when we have both pages present, we will ask them to introduce themselves. Oh, there she is. All right. So, that will then be our first order of business. We do have two new pages attached to the committee this year, who have already demonstrated their congeniality and competence, and we would like both to take a moment to introduce themselves and tell us a little bit about you, please. Melissa, if you'd like to go first.
Okay. Hi, my name is Melissa Lamb. I am a recent graduate from the University of Minnesota, and I am a first-time page, and hopefully I am living up to everyone's expectations. So I am here to help.
And I think members are always interested in where you came from. What's your hometown? And
I am originally from Coon Rapids, Minnesota.
Well, point out that Representative Johnson, our resident East Sider, has missed your introduction, but we'll make up for that later. So, thank you very much. Deputy Commissioner Garvey and Mr. Bull, if you want to pick up where we left off and finish up that portion of our review, we would be grateful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mike Bull, Deputy Director of the Minnesota Office of Energy Security at the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and Edward and I are also both graduates of the University of Minnesota, if you're interested.
We'll make a note of that, Mr. Bull. Thank you.
Hopefully their standards have gone up since we were there.
Mr. Chair, I think we were going to start. We're working through this table, the status report, the 2007 Energy Appropriations and Studies Status Report document that I provided the committee, and we're on page 15.
That's correct, Mr. Bull.
Out of 24. So I'll sort of work through these fairly quickly. This portion of the document is energy appropriations and studies that were required last session, or appropriated last session, or required last session of folks other than us. But I wanted to make sure that you had a full picture of what is going on, or as full as I can provide. Edward's here to answer any tough questions you might have.
As always.
So, Ivy, last session you provided continued funding for the Initiative for Renewable Energy and Environment at the University of Minnesota. There is an ongoing issue, Mr. Chair, that you and I have spoken about with regard to whether or not their funding after 2011 is base funding. I've let the folks at Xcel know, as well as the university, that it's my understanding that it's your understanding that it is base funding, but that might be something to be made clear going forward.
Well, your understanding is correct, Mr. Bull, and if we need to clarify that, we'll certainly attempt to do that.
The St. Paul Port Authority, Rock 10, there was a grant, we were a pass-through on that grant of $4.5 million to the St. Paul Port Authority and district heating to begin planning and engineering for a steam plant to serve Rock 10, and $500,000 to DNR to make biomass from public lands available. My understanding is that that project is within that local community around where the project would be. They've been fairly intense, but they're ongoing and trying to work through some of the issues that have been identified there.
Mr. Ball, with regard to the Rock 10 question, as I'm sure you're as aware as I, one of the big questions is about what is an eligible fuel to be considered. My feeling is that the bill that we passed was fairly clear on that, in that regard. Could you tell us what your understanding is?
Mr. Chair, actually, I'd have to refresh my recollection and look at the language. But I do remember a lot of discussions in that conference committee. There were at the end of the session, and there were different proposals about, and then different definitions of what was included and what was excluded. And the fundamental question was whether or not refuse-derived fuel as a biomass resource would be included. I think the way the grantors, are they them? Is that St. Paul? The people getting the money, the way I think they're reading the statute is that it includes a wide variety of biomass resources, including RDF. And so that, if that's not the intent, maybe that'd be something to look at.
Well, actually, since this question has arisen over and over, I did go back and look at the bill that we passed, the conference committee report, and part of what it states is that an eligible energy technology has meaning given in Minnesota statutes, Section 216B, 1691, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Subdivision 1, except that it does not include mixed municipal solid waste as an eligible energy technology.
Well, there you go, Mr. Chair. That's as clear as can be then, that it should not be included in part of the thing.
Well, that's the impression that I had. And Mr. Bull, if you, at your leisure, could just review that whole thing, I would be interested if you come up with a different conclusion than I have.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
But, Mr. Chair, that was a hard question, and so that was supposed to go.
Oh, sorry about that. We'll make up for that with the next question.
Very good. Page 16, the Center for Rural Policy. It's a rural create a rural wind initiative pass-through grant. The Center for Rural Policy, in this case, is the pass-through grantor. The a selection, we went through, I was on an advisory board for the Center for Rural Policy to look at the app. This is Representative Knuth's bill from last session. We looked at a number of applications to provide this rural wind technical assistance. We ended up settling on a combined project with the Seabed Initiative, which is a nonprofit organization to work on community-based energy development, and the Southwest Initiative Foundation down in Southwest Minnesota, where there are a lot of wind development currently ongoing. They have agreed, as I understand it, SWIFT did, to match the million state dollars, so that it provides a $2 million program for technical assistance for community energy. We have the grant contract in place with the Center for Rural Policy, and I think they're in just final negotiations with SWIFT and Seabed and the Center to finalize their their relationship. Pollution Control Agency, this was a Representative Peterson's initiative, as I recall, to develop a biomass gasification emissions inventory, characterizing the air emissions from various feedstocks from biomass gasification projects. The PCA has had a number of meetings to work with stakeholders, and now they're going through some testing, or will be going through some testing this spring and summer of various feedstocks characterizing that those emissions. Representative Peterson, you might be interested to know that we used this as a template for something that we worked with in the Midwest Governors Association platform, where to have this kind of, to the extent that each individual state in this collaboration has some of this kind of information, we wanted to make sure to facilitate the sharing across those states of this kind of information to sort of bolster the work, so that this was something we spent quite a bit of time talking about.
Mr. Bull, or perhaps Representative Peterson, does someone know, in the testing of various feedstocks, are these tests being conducted just on each of the possibilities individually, or are they also being tested in combination? Since I think there could probably be some difference between how they perform individually compared to how they perform in combination.
Mr. Chair, my understanding, which is limited, is that there will be some combination testing as well as individual feedstock testing. But I can get clear information for you on that if the committee would be so kind.
Thank you.
Page 17, $400,000 for a feasibility study for a plasma torch gasification facility up in Kuching. And I know you've had quite a bit of discussion about plasma torch gasification, so you probably know as much as you want to know about that. There were a number of...
Mr. Bull, do you know how that has proceeded? Has that been accomplished at this point?
Mr. Chair,
I don't think we've had any report to that effect.
I don't know at this time what the status of that feasibility study is, which is the problem is that square across from that is blank, so I don't have any information for that. But I can follow that up on that as well.
Since that was something of a hard question, perhaps Deputy Commissioner Garvey could answer that one.
Mr. Members of the committee, I know exactly as much.
Okay.
Mr. Bull, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, there were a number of appropriations that were in the ag finance bill that relate to some of the work that we're interested in here in this committee. The next one is one of those grant to Chisago County for a feasibility study on a multi-stream renewable energy biofuels demonstration facility in Chisago, Ashanti, or Pine County, working with cellulose material. That each of these appropriations are to have a report to the legislature by the beginning of this month. There's a number of them in this report, but I haven't seen any of those reports yet. And as soon as I'm going to try to track those down, and as I do, I'll get all of those to this committee so that you can know as much as we know.
Well, as a resident of Pine County, I can assure you that we do have a lot of cellulosic material.
I believe
some of it in my yard, unfortunately.
Page 18, there was an appropriation to the Department of Natural Resources for a pass-through grant to evaluate the state's potential for terrestrial carbon sequestration. There was some of that money went to the Minnesota Geologic Survey to look at geologic carbon sequestration. Reports are due in June. We might, if folks are interested, we could ask for an update on how those studies are going. Also, Mr. Chair, on page 19, also in the ag finance bill, there was $3 million for what was referred to as the Next Gen Bioenergy Grant. These are for grants for owners of Minnesota facilities producing bioenergy or organizations that provide on-station, on-farm, field-scale research and outreach. Essentially to work on bioenergy projects and bioenergy research. The Department of Agriculture is working on developing priorities for that RFP and working also with the chairs of the Next Gen Board to get clarity on that for an RFP to be issued in late spring. The grant to the Turf Seed Council, the Biomass Fuel Supply Depot, and the, all the projects on page 20 are also in that ag finance bill, are also bioenergy related projects, and are also to have a report due to the legislature by February 1st. Those are the reports that I'll promise to track down and get back to you. But just briefly, one of the projects is for the creation of a centrally located biomass fuel supply depot. My understanding is that's in relation to the raw malting and CODA energy project that is ongoing with the Shakopee Sioux. That's a very interesting project that the committee might be interested in hearing about generally. The next two are feasibility studies for essentially cellulose biofuel projects, one with the Boyfort Band of Chippewa and one with the Whiter Band of Chippewa. And then finally, Chair, on this page, page 20, is a project, again, for plasma gasification process with the Elk River Economic Development Project, I think in combination with Great River Energy, if I'm not mistaken. Page 21 of this table is the start. One of the legislature last session created a RIM clean energy project program, and this after the creation of the project of the program, Bowser was to pull together a number of stakeholders to develop the program guidelines for this project. Which they have done, and now funding is pending. Funding requests are pending before the bonding committees of the legislature to fund the Bowser program. This next one, the Governor's Task Force on Competitiveness of the Primary Forest Product Industry, was not a legislative requirement. But I think we provided this detail when I provided the earlier table to the Next Gen Board about things that are ongoing. The one of the key components of this of the report from the Governor's Task Force has to do with how to incorporate the forest product industry into our renewable energy programs and policies generally. Mr. Chair, page 22, there's a native grasses report due from the Department of Natural Resources. I think, Mr. Chair, this was a requirement that Representative Wagenius initiative to look at criteria to identify public and private marginal lands which could be used to produce native prairie seeds of a local ecotype or restore native prairie. That could be used to produce clean energy. So I think this could be well coordinated with the RIN-CE program. That report was submitted December 15th of 2007. Page 23, and I'm nearing the end of my document here. There's a PCA biofuels permitting report that PCA was to take the lead on with DNR and the EQB. The proposal, the report was due January 15th of 2008, but as I understand it, there's a drafting circulated amongst those three agencies, so it is not quite ready. That key portions of the report were done by MNTAP, the Minnesota Technical Assistance Program at the U, and I think the agencies are targeting the end of this month for a final publication based on that. And then, Mr. Chair, the DNR was appropriated $500,000 in fiscal year 2008 to address groundwater issues associated with the ethanol industry. And it's my understanding that they've hired three hydrologists with that money and are working to better characterize groundwater resources. And if you'll recall, Mr. Chair, this was an issue we discussed a lot within the NextGen Energy Board, and we have a recommendation around that about providing additional information on water resources. And then the last page is the requirement to deed for a renewable energy economic benefit strategy. They provided a interim report to the Electric Energy Task Force in August and a final report, as I understand it, in mid-November. But I couldn't find a copy of that in my files, Mr. Chair, so I'll have to track that.
I do have a copy of the interim report, Mr. Bull, but I have the same situation as you regarding any final report. But since one of the reportees is sitting next to you, perhaps, Deputy Commissioner, you could tell us what progress has been made on the strategy since the interim report.
This statute requires that deed work in consultation with you, Director Garson.
Thanks for that clarification, Mr. Ball.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have been completely and absolutely consulted, but beyond that, I have no further information that I can illuminate with you as to the final draft of that document.
Mr. Chair, I will track down that final document.
Well, final document or none, Commissioner, have there been discussions ongoing since that initial report, and can you reveal any of the strategizing that has taken place?
Mr. Chair.
I've
had quite a number of conversations with folks from DEED and AG on this. The folks at DEED have done quite a bit of work. Besides reaching out to try to recruit manufacturers to the state, they've also gone through a fairly detailed process to identify the folks that are already here who are in the state, manufacturing facilities that could be manufacturing components to that could be incorporated into, for example, wind turbines, the nacelle of a wind turbine, but that are currently making other stuff. So that we do have one of the benefits of the work that they've done is to identify the current manufacturers in the state that can help be a supply chain to support a wind turbine manufacturer here as part of their recruitment efforts.
Well, unless something has changed about that, my understanding is that DEED has devoted the efforts of one semi-retired employee to this project. Are you aware of any further efforts in that regard? I mean, it seems to me, compared to other states, what they're doing, having teams of people going all over the world trying to pursue similar ideas. Do we have any prospect of actually getting anywhere with this?
That's a hard question, Mr. Chair.
that's why the Deputy Commissioner is there with you, as he explained earlier.
I wasn't aware that individual is semi-retired. I know that there is one primary point person for that effort. There is a couple of folks that help support him in that. But it is, you know, I'll just put a period after that.
Well, insofar as the Office of Energy Security is participating in those discussions, I would really strongly suggest that you try to put a little more energy into that effort.
Duly noted, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that note, Head Director, Deputy Commissioner, Mr. Administrator, Deputy Director, Mr. Assistant Commissioner, the few of us on this committee sought to invigorate our efforts or reinvigorate our efforts on the green jobs piece, hoping to be on the short list, the final list for the Vestas Research and Development Center. We learned late last week, Sunday night actually, Monday morning in Europe, that we did not make the short list. 80 high-end jobs that should be in Minnesota. And I believe that if you read the communication from Vestas, their impression of our capacity is very different than our actual capacity. We should be on that short list based on our merit. There are a number of projects for which we should be at the table and in the game. I think you can hear from the sound of my voice that I'm frustrated and disappointed that we have a lot of opportunities for which there's bipartisan agreement and energy towards making the jobs happen. We will be putting some incentives on the table this session to this effort, but I think I respect and enjoy working with the two of you and your office and department a great deal. And I think that we need to redouble our efforts and find a way to put Minnesota in front of the people who can make decisions so they actually see the merits of our workforce, of our quality of life, and of the incentives that we can put forward. We have the fastest growing market in wind energy, certainly. I believe we're at the game on energy efficiency as well. We need to get snappy here. And I think that you guys feel the same commitment that we do. Let's put our heads together and figure that out. To a question, Mr. Chair.
Does that have Kayla?
I noticed that in the organizational chart that in order to make a lot of the mandates and the requirements and the goals that we laid out together last year, we need the staff to do it. And I noticed that there are two vacant positions under the SIP division. But yesterday we heard of a hiring freeze. What's the impact on MOES of a hiring freeze and our ability to boost our economy on the energy side?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Kalin. You're correct. The governor has imposed a hiring freeze on all state agencies and state agency heads, with a number of exceptions. I am in the process of working with Commissioner Wilson and the colleagues to sort of ascertain exactly what that means and how that affects our respective agency.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Garvey, when can you report back to this committee with some more thorough information on the impact on the agencies? I think even some of our utilities in the audience are going to want to know the impacts on the support staff and the direction as they're working towards their first filings and coming up to speed here.
Mr. Garvin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Kalin, there are two things that are worth sort of delineating. First is whether or not we could fill those two specific vacancies that is identified on the organizational chart that you have before you, or not under the hiring freeze. The second one is, what was our timetable for actually filling them at all to begin with? And let me address that second one. The demand efficiency provision of the Next Generation Act allows for the additions of three additional full-time equivalents in the energy efficiency. We're in the process of sorting through and not bringing them on as we were in the process of bringing them on as we were sort of ramping that program up. Now, our organizational chart was designed to reflect the full vacancy, the full set of complements, but we were not going to, we weren't intending to basically bring in everyone automatically, because we understood that the needs of what we were going to be doing in the first 18 months of implementing the demand efficiency is going to be different than what we will be needing to do in the next 18 months. And so just to make sure we're clear, as you're going to identify a specific vacancy, FT spots on an organizational chart, you need to basically understand the specific context on that. The question that you're, the more specific question is, these are funded by fees that would be generated from utilities. And so the thing I need to clarify is whether or not the hiring freeze applies to those kinds of programs. For the record, I'm assuming that they are and that they will not get filled until the hiring freeze is lifted. But I don't know that for fact.
Commissioner, there are actually on your chart 8 vacancies indicated. Would that same observation apply to all of those?
Mr. Chairman, let me just do a quick scan. We've identified two vacancies under the fifth demand efficiency. I think I just expressed them. There are 3 vacancies identified under the energy facility and permitting. We have, in the first half of this month, I believe, filled 2 of those spots. Make sure. Yes. We have two additional folks on that. So the other part of this is that, as I go through this, there's a vacancy of a public utility planner, financial analyst 3. That's a vacancy from a departure. The expansion, let me go through the others. If I add them up quickly, that's 8. Oh, yeah, the reliability administrator. We're desperately seeking someone to do that. But then again, that may be subject to the hiring freeze, too, as well as a statutory change of the requirement, which we discussed on Monday, Mr. Chair.
So would the implication of that mean that the temporary reliability administrator is frozen in place? Commissioner Garvey?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that the hiring freeze is a reaction and a needed thing on behalf of the state due to budget implications, and the governor has made an indication that we're sort of making those kinds of decisions, that we're not going to be filling vacancies. So Until I'm told otherwise, I'm not going to be pursuing any filling of any of the vacancies that I have in my office.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Ball.
Eddie was asking a perspective.
Yes, for the time being, we are stuck with me.
Wanted to make sure. Are there other questions? Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the testifiers. I had a constituent living in my district who contacted me, brought to my attention a renewable energy expo that was taking place in Las Vegas, and she said that she'd try to bring it to the attention of the department and to Office of Energy. My question to the two of you is, I see the governor on trade missions, and I think it's good that he is trying to extend the hand out to China, to India, to the other countries that he's been visiting. But in the area of energy, are we taking a kind of a laid-back approach and hoping things will fall in our lap in the state and we'll be able to recruit some of the businesses that are coming forward, that are looking for places to locate? Or do you have any staff or any individuals that are actually going out throughout the country, maybe even throughout the world, going to these energy expos or having discussions with people to try to actually create business and jobs and opportunity in the state regarding all renewables?
Representative Welty, this relates back to the question of, that we were talking about with the report that and the work that DEED has been doing. For the most part, we are a regulatory agency and a advocacy organization for policies and projects and technologies. The lead agency for economic development in this area, as well as the rest of the business development, is the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and they do have staff that are working on this. We identified at least one that isn't working in this area, and I think that if you want to get a detailed sense of what they are doing, we should ask them to come in,
and we will do that. Representative Wagenian.
Mr. Chair, in a number of states, there are scientists working on growing algae and sewage to make oil. We have one of those scientists at the University of Minnesota. What are you doing, or are you doing anything to help with this effort?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, one of the projects that Roger Ruano, I think is who you're referring to, is working with the Met Council. In one of his projects is to develop algae development in the context of their wastewater sewage. So in that regard, we are intimately involved in development of that algae project. I think it's a great
one. Mr. Garvey. Representative Green, the Metropolitan Council is also pursuing a law change to allow that kind of technology to be treated as a renewable energy resource. And we believe that that's a good. So the administration is pursuing it from that perspective, too.
Mr. Dunn.
Well, actually, it's been very difficult to get the Met Council to firm up and say that they were going to fund this. They were saying, no, we can't fund it unless we had a law change, and now they've found some money, and I was feeling very uncomfortable that they were going to be able to get the job done. So I think that is a problem. And it is a very small scale effort where Professor Roon has had trouble getting money. I mean, let's finally get money from Xcel Energy. Are we doing anything besides this fairly reluctant Met Council effort?
Mr. Bull?
Mr. Chair, Representative Genius, I had not heard any complaints about the council's commitment on, in this regard. The person that I work with pretty closely, that Ed and I both work very closely with over there, Jason Millett, is very excited about the project, and will be testifying in favor of, well, helping Representative Gardner with his bill, I think, that's coming up in this committee soon. I also sit on the Xcel Energy Renewable Development Fund board and was very supportive of the grant to Dr. Ruin's project as well.
Representative Lavinia?
Thank you. Are you doing anything any further than just that one effort?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenius, nothing else comes to mind in that, on the algae for oil.
Yes, it seems like a huge opportunity that might, someplace else might do a better job faster. And that's the whole question that is around this table. Are there people moving faster, getting the job done? And I'm concerned that it was only like yesterday that I heard a final commitment from that council that they would fund this project. Reluctant before, so I'm not feeling comfortable about the effort.
Mr. Genius, as you have concerns like that, please express them to us, and we can work within the administration to make things happen. Try to.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say that House File 2903, which deals with wastewater and renewable energy, isn't going to be heard in this committee on Monday. I have some issues. I got to talk to the next council about that first. This morning, you know.
And we were aware of that, but thank you for bringing that up. Representative Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to go back to what Representative Kalin brought up about this recruiting businesses to the state and some of the dynamics about this and this opportunity that I just want to get on the record with this, with Vestas, the world's largest wind turbine manufacturer, is that it wasn't all negative, though. I mean, but there's some things that kind of just, well, it was most disappointing, but I was thoroughly impressed with, after sending a letter December 5th, on my letterhead, and having Jeremy sign it to Governor Plenty and President Brunix, that, you know, the day after Christmas, the world's largest wind turbine manufacturer called me on my cell phone and said, hey, we got your letter. You know, so that was okay. But after that, the University of Minnesota, I would say, I was very, very impressed with their response. And the University of Minnesota at Morris, if I can be a little bit provincial. They already have a turbine, so that might be a good fit. And Will Steger, you know, I talked to Will before he had his summit with Plenty up on the up in Ely, and it got brought up, and you know, he was very willing to use his name overseas and help us out, and also the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. They're very impressed with their response to this opportunity. I mean, that's formal, making the assumption that the world's largest wind turbine manufacturing company would actually bring their research and design development out of Denmark. We made that assumption. Okay, and then let's see if we can get them to Minnesota. But what was most disappointing, and I'm not picking on you guys, and I'm just saying this for the record, was this like, who's taking responsibility for it? I mean, okay, well, we heard about it first, and then it's our deal. But no, we wrote this letter, and we don't want to work. IRE's doing that, and Deed's here, and the U of M's over here, and I don't know who in the governor's office is doing it. Does Garvey handle this, or is it, whose is this? And, well, we saw the letter first, and we drafted a response, and it's just like, okay, that's, nothing happened. You know, so I guess my question is, if I send a letter to the governor, and it sits there for 3 weeks, and Jeremy and I have to have a press conference in order to see another updated flyer from Deed that
shows MET towers across the upper Midwest, where we're measuring wind. It's the same flyer that we handed out in Los Angeles together, which I'm happy to do. But that's really not cutting it. So if I send a letter to the governor, should I not send one? Should I have the Speaker of the House send one? I mean, how do I get a response from the governor's office is what I'm trying to find out. Because even in Washington, D.C., if you're in the minority, if you're in the majority or anything, you send a letter, you get a response right away. It's like, yes, we got your letter. We don't think it's a very good idea. We don't care about your project, but at least you got a letter. You know, it'd be good to know who gets it, who gets it, who deals with it. I mean, Chair Hilty had to tell, you know, Commissioner McElroy about it. That's a sorry state of affairs, I guess. But I don't want to be just completely negative, but there was good response to this from those outside of the Capitol, unfortunately.
I don't need a response. It's okay.
Gentlemen, there were a few remaining items, just brief updates that you were intending to get to, I believe. That's entitled on your on the sheet that you gave us on Monday, Big Energy Matters.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you did ask for a number of quick updates. A couple of ones that you specifically mentioned, Mr. Chair, was an update on the Big Stone 2 and the Excelsior Energy's Mesaba facility proposal, and I've added a couple others just for your notice. The Big Stone 2, as you may know, last fall, a couple of the partners withdrew from the original facility proposal. The remaining partners put together another proposal. That proposal is now going through the regulatory review process before an administrative law judge. Final legal briefs to the administrative law judge were due and were filed a week ago today. The administrative law judge will issue their ruling, because there's actually a pair of them, I believe in middle to end of March. There'll be comments on that or exceptions, and it will go to the Public Utilities Commission for decision in April. Mr. Chairman, the Excelsior Energy's Mesaba 1 facility is also going through in multiple phases through the Public Utilities Commission review process. The Public Utilities Commission has asked the facility proposers to work with Xcel Energy to see if they can develop a power purchase agreement that is acceptable to both of them and to bring it back to them. They have been providing updates to the Commission on their efforts. Carbon regulatory costs. Pursuant to one of the final provisions of the Next Generation Act, 216H.06, I believe the law required the Public Utilities Commission to establish a range of potential regulatory costs or costs that they will incorporate into their planning of new facilities, with a expectation that those could be the potential costs for future carbon regulatory costs. In December, the Public Utilities Commission issued an order that set a range of $4 to $30 for their consideration. The next item on the list is low-income heating energy assistance. The state of Minnesota has received $104 million from the federal government for low-income heating energy assistance, and it's 105 on the sheet because this committee and the legislature provided $1 million of additional funding, so it's a total of $105 million. We are in the process of providing, we've provided almost all of that money to Minnesotans, primarily through direct energy assistance, i.e. the payment of bills, but it's also used for weatherization, emergency energy repairs, and those kinds of things. And I'll leave it to Mike to give a quick briefing on MREC. Mr. Chair, just real quick, if you'll recall that the renewable electricity standard legislation that was chief authored here by Representative Peterson also included a provision requiring the Public Utilities Commission to have a renewable energy tracking system and credit program up in place by the end of this past year. And I just wanted to report to you that we have that the commission has done that. The Midwest Regional Energy Tracking System is up and running, and it's a we are working in a again with our regional neighboring states on that program. So that's all.
Thank you, Mr. Bull. Are there questions before we go to the rest of the Department of Commerce?
The good part.
Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen. I'm sure we'll be seeing more of you later. Next on the agenda, we have the Department of Commerce. And seeing that we do have a quorum present, we also have the minutes from February 18th meeting to consider. I think the reason that Representative Gardner arrived late is that he was considering the minutes outside in private. And Representative Gardner, are you prepared to make a motion regarding the minutes?
I am, Mr. Chair. I see that's the penalty for coming late.
Representative Gardner moves approval of the minutes February 18th. Are there any additions or corrections? I believe. No. Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a correction on the second page. The end of the first paragraph there, then should be changed to then.
Yes, I see. Thank you. Duly noted. Are there any other additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of the approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Minutes are approved. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty. Members of the committee, my name is Manny Munson-Regala. I'm the new Deputy Commissioner for the Market Assurance Division for the Department of Commerce. With the Chair and the Committee's indulgence, I want to briefly give you a short summary of my background, a little bit about the mission of the Market Assurance Division, and I understand you wanted us to talk a little bit about a database breach that we suffered sometime over the holidays at the end of last year.
Yes, thank you.
I was appointed to the position on January 22nd, so I've been roughly in the job for about a month. Prior to coming to Commerce, I worked in the private industry as an insurance regulatory attorney for 22 years. I've worked for large and small companies, foreign and domestic companies. I've also had opportunities to work with regulators in most of the other states. I thought that my career path would include public service at some point, so I was pleased and honored when the commissioner called to ask me to be his new deputy for market assurance. I look forward to working with you and the committee. Since joining the division, I've been working on learning the mission of the division, assessing the resources we currently have, learning more about the processes we have in place, determining whether or not there are any efficiencies that we can achieve, and I've been working with the commissioner on possible budget recommendations. As you know, market assurance is the enforcement and licensing arm of the Commerce Department. Our license department issues and renews the licenses of over 190,000 professionals and a number of industries, including insurance, real estate, and collection agencies. We also reviewed the forms and rates of the insurance products sold in Minnesota. But most of the work at Market Assurance is in the investigations or enforcement area. In order to accomplish the investigative work, we have a number of teams or units. The first team or unit is our Consumer Response Team, or the CRT, another acronym. They're our first line of service for many of our consumers. They take calls and they look to try to resolve disputes quickly and informally. If investigations are going to take more time and require a formal file being opened, we refer that to our investigative unit. They not only investigate insurance concerns, but they also deal with real estate, mortgage originators, securities, appraisers, collection agencies, and essentially the industries that we regulate. Now, some complaints may involve practice or pattern on the part of a company or agency. In that case, we refer those matters to our Market Connect team. That team conducts exams on companies, agents, agencies, and related parties. Those exams are triggered by a variety of sources, complaints, internal referrals, inquiries from the legislature. You'll sometimes ask us what's going on in a particular area of commerce, activity in other states, and data analysis. We work with other state regulators on multi-state examinations. In fact, we're now the lead state in at least 4 multi-state exams. The Market Connect team has recently been focusing on 3 areas: title insurance, suitability of annuities, and workers' compensation. We also have a new insurance fraud unit created by the legislature in 2004 and funded by the insurance industry. While there's some overlap between the exam team and the fraud unit, essentially the exam team works on civil cases and the fraud unit will work on matters that will be referred to for criminal prosecution. Finally, the most significant budget change in 2007 was the addition of real estate investigators to our real estate mortgage unit. Thanks to your help and assistance, we were able to increase the size of the team last year, and we've been able to actively work with our various county prosecutors, especially Hennepin County, the folks down in Bloomington, on identifying and responding to abuses in the marketplace. I know that my colleague Kevin Murphy is going to spend more time talking about our activities in the mortgage area. The last note or item I wanted to discuss with you is that I understand you wanted to learn a little bit more about a stolen laptop that occurred sometime over the holiday last year. We had a vendor that had personal data on a number of our licensees, roughly 200 or so, on their laptop. The laptop was password protected, but the data was not encrypted. That laptop was stolen from the vendor. They notified us. Upon being notified, we contacted all of those licensees by phone to let them know that, first of all, the data had been stolen. We were not sure whether any of it had been compromised, but at least that the laptop had been stolen, and that the vendor was going to pay for 1 year of anti-fraud service. We also now require that contractor to have all storage devices encrypted in the future, so an additional layer of protection. Finally, we have had no information that any licensee's identity has been compromised. That's all I have, Mr. Chair. Is there any questions from the committee or from you?
Are there questions from members? let's proceed with Mr. Murphy, and if there are questions, we can deal with him after your presentation, Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Kevin Murphy, Deputy Commissioner. I've been with the Commerce Department as a deputy for almost 10 years. My previous experience includes 10 years as a federal bank regulator with the FDIC, followed by 12 years as a private sector consultant. I was hired at the end of the Carlson administration. I've been reappointed by the Ventura and the Valenti administrations. I'd also like to thank Commissioner Garvey and Mike Bull for saving the planet.
we're all very grateful, Commissioner Murphy.
My I work in the Financial Examinations Division, and we're responsible for licensing and regulating banks, credit unions, finance companies, check cashers, payday lenders, and the like. We do the licensing of mortgage originators under Chapter 58. We handle the financial regulation, solvency of insurance companies. We have about 75 people. We use contractors for the insurance company examinations. We're generally self-funded. We charge the industries for what we do. Much of our time is spent making sure that our money is safe at banks, credit unions, and insurance companies. We've spent a lot of time in the mortgage industry in the last couple of years. Several laws were passed in the last session dealing with mortgage issues. Our proposal strengthened the regulation of mortgage companies. They must be a business entity, no more licensing human beings. We have net worth and surety bond requirements. We established an education requirement for mortgage brokers. We are given the authority to examine mortgage companies and charge for the exams. Our proposal made mortgage fraud a specific crime in Minnesota. But the overall concept of our bill was to license business entities and make them responsible for their employees and representatives. The Attorney General had two bills to pass also that made a lot of improvements in the mortgage area. They required verification of a borrower's ability to repay a loan. They included the so-called yield spread premium fee paid by a lender to a broker in the 5% cap on lender fees. Their proposal changed the relationship between a mortgage broker and a consumer. A mortgage broker is now required to act in the best interest of the consumer. Their bill prohibited negative amortization loans, provided a private right of action for borrowers against companies in the case of violations, gave consumers a private right of action against appraisers for violations. We've spent a lot of time in the last year understanding and implementing these last couple changes. Lots of meetings with the industries. We pushed back the license renewal date from August till the end of October to accommodate all the new changes. Some of the outcomes from all that, the number of entities licensed under Chapter 58, the mortgage company law, went from about 4,000 down to about 1,250, which was kind of by design, but not quite as bad as it sounds because they don't license the human beings anymore. But there has been a decline in the number of people in that business. Much of the market for subprime loans has disappeared. Wall Street has figured out that that's a costly business, and they've stopped buying those loans. We're in the process of implementing the mortgage company examination program. We posted a job for an individual to head that unit. We hired a guy named Dan Mitchell from a field of 85 applicants, a very well-qualified person. He was a police officer, including a detective, for about 20 years. He was in the mortgage business for 12 years. He's a Vietnam veteran, and he's the former president of the Mortgage Trade Association, the chair of their education committee, so we're pleased to have him on board. We've had a lot of questions about the new laws, and we put a lot of frequently asked questions and answers on our webpage concerning the new laws. A lot of questions still remain, and many in the industry are trying to figure out ways to circumvent the new laws. We'll have a very modest proposal in 2008, and that proposal relates to the scope of Chapter 58, and it's come to our attention over the last year or so that Chapter 58 only covers owner-occupied homes, and the Chapter 58 provides important protection for both lenders and borrowers. And, of course, most of the laws in the housing and the real estate industry deal with all 1-to-4 family loans that are covered by these various laws. And so we'll propose to change the scope of Chapter 58 to cover all 1-to-4 family properties, whether or not they're owner-occupied. And probably the most important reason to make that change is the laws making mortgage fraud a specific crime in another chapter. They refer back to the definitions in Chapter 58, so we think that that's an important change. That was about all I had prepared, but I can try to answer any questions.
Commissioner Murphy, I think that what we're experiencing is that the kind of credit problems that we have seen associated with subprime mortgages and sort of extending out further and farther to other mortgages and to credit card debt, student loans, etc. Is the department kind of monitoring that situation, and do you have an assessment of where that is going?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we are trying to monitor that. I do have some statistics on Minnesota mortgage loans that might be of interest to you. These are, I think, the most recent stuff available to me, and it says it's September 30, so it's a little bit behind, but still relatively current. I'd say nationally, as a starting point, about 35% of homes are free and clear, and they don't have a mortgage, so we're down to like 65% of homes that have mortgages. Overall, about 3% of all Minnesota mortgage loans are seriously delinquent and or in foreclosure. And that's from a survey about 900,000 mortgage loans, which would be a big chunk of the mortgage loans in Minnesota.
And how does that compare historically, Commissioner Murphy?
It's a little bit higher. But let me go on. I have a couple more data. But out of those 900,000 loans that are covered by this data, about 10% of those loans are in the what they call the subprime category. In the subprime category of the fixed-rate loans, about 7% of the subprime fixed-rate loans are either seriously delinquent or in foreclosure. But where the problem really shows up is in the subprime adjustable rate loans, about 20%.
Could you move closer to the mic? I think some of the members are having difficulty hearing.
Sure. I was saying about 20% of the subprime adjustable rate loans are either seriously delinquent or in foreclosure. So that's really where the biggest problem is, and I think that kind of jives with, you know, what we're all reading in the news media. As far as the credit cards and all the rest of that, if you know, when we have a downturn, so problems increase. The fortunes of banks and credit unions are largely dependent on the fortunes of their customers. So if the customers are experiencing difficulty, that will show up in the financial institution. So we are monitoring that, and we have watch lists and all that kind of thing.
Well, first let me ask, are there questions? Did you have a question, Representative Ruth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We were trying to determine what the first number that you mentioned was. Was it 3%? You said overall 35% of the homes are mortgage free. And then the next statistic you gave, that's what we were all trying to determine what you said.
Mr. Representative, I'm sorry you couldn't hear me, but the number was about 3% of all Minnesota mortgage loans are either seriously delinquent or in foreclosure. I don't have a real fix for what that's been historically, but I know that it's up.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? Commissioner, all right. Representative Wagenius.
Well, when you say you're watching us, are you doing anything besides watching it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, we have a small army of people in our division who are out constantly checking on banks and credit unions and finance companies, so we visit them periodically and we take turns with our federal counterparts, and if they're not doing a good job, we beat up on them. So we are doing a lot of that stuff.
Hey, commissioners, is there sense that there are problems in that regard that are looming, or is Minnesota relative to the problem nationally in reasonably good shape?
Mr. Chairman, that's kind of a broad question. But I would say that there probably are some problems on the horizon, but I think they'll be manageable, and one of our jobs is to mitigate the damage to citizens if we do have a failure in the financial arena.
Members, are there further questions? Well, seeing none.
Were you getting ready to ask a question?
Representative Wagenius, you pretty much asked my question, but did you have another?
Well, you seem to be giving us the sense that we can anticipate a financial problem that you will have to mitigate. Give us some probabilities here. And how many?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we regulate, for example, about 330 state banks. And they're generally the smaller banks. You know, it's not the Wells Fargo or the U.S. Bank. I'd say our list of what we call troubled banks is about 9 or 10% of the total, and that's probably doubled over the last 5 years. We've issued two enforcement actions in the last several months on banks experiencing some difficulties. It's within the realm of possibility that we would experience a bank failure in the next year or two. So I'm not talking about a catastrophe, but it could be a little bit bumpy in the next couple of years.
If I could follow up?
Certainly, Representative Wagenius.
So if we are talking about 10% and you regulate 300, you're talking about 30 banks that have problems.
Yes, Mr. Representative.
About 30. And you think that, I'm feeling this, you think there's a probability that we're going to see those problems in public. How many of those 30 might really have trouble that we see, that they may fail? What's the number?
Representative, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry I didn't hear
Mr.
all the question. Somebody coughed.
Of the 30, what percentage do you think are at risk of failure? Or what number, either one?
I would say, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I would say that there are one or two that could fail in the coming year.
In the coming year?
Yes.
And what would be an action that, is there an action we should take to make sure that doesn't happen?
Mr. Murphy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, not sure that there's anything the legislature can do to prevent that from happening, but we and our federal counterparts would have cease and desist orders and several other remedial measures that we would put on the troubled institutions, which would mandate them to make a certain number of corrections. Now, they may or may not actually do that, and it may or may not succeed. But we spend a lot of time with troubled entities. The usual outcome, and I worked for the FDIC for many years, and in the 80s, one of my jobs was to arrange mergers for failing banks, so I have a fair amount of experience in that world. So if a bank were to reach the point where it was likely to fail, we would arrange a merger of that bank with a more healthy institution. What's changed since the 80s, though, is that the FDIC used to usually bail out all depositors, including those with accounts over $100,000. That's no longer true. The FDIC does not have that latitude. So if a bank were to fail, people that had more than a $100,000 insured limit would be at risk. So we would go to considerable lengths to, number one, avoid a failure. And if we did see one looming, we would be putting a lot of pressure on that bank to meet with their customers that have big balances and send them a message to get it down to a more manageable size. So there is quite a mechanism and quite a body of experience to deal with these situations, and it seems to come along with the business cycle. So I'm certainly not predicting doom and gloom, but there certainly is the possibility that one or two banks could fail in the coming year.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick observation. I think that this discussion actually raises a larger question that I believe we'll be addressing this session on this committee. Representative Root has a bill that may address this, but the sort of awkwardness of turning on a dime from energy issues to very complex issues of commercial regulation and commerce issues that are at the center of the difficult economic times in the state. And I think we need to have a discussion. I believe that the chair has indicated that we will this session have a discussion about the appropriateness of the structure of the existing department and within the administration, so that we can have the folks who have deep familiarity with these issues actually at the table. I actually want to say on my own sake that someone in the folks on our side of the table here have a long relationship and history with these issues. I appreciate you coming before our committee, but I also think that we need to have the best and brightest minds in the specific field on both sides of the table. But I also think that Representative Guardines was getting at the point of the pitfalls of a laissez-faire approach. Historically, I think we need to have some more teeth on all sides of the table here as we try to right the ship as fast as we can and avoid any more murky and troubled waters ahead.
Representative Wagini?
Is that right? You've talked about a group of 300 banks and your experience with those. Are there things that you are observing or should observe to us about outside of those 300 banks where we can expect trouble and we should be thinking about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius.
Commissioner Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that the banks and credit unions are in a similar category. Credit unions tend to be more in the retail business and the business lending business, so I would say that banking is probably a little bit more risky. If you look at a balance sheet of a bank, the asset side is pretty much loans, which is a fairly high-risk area of lending and investment. If you look at insurance companies, their balance sheet is mostly a bond portfolio, which for the most part are less risky than lending, but of course then there's all these subprime securitized bonds, which are a whole other matter, and we keep asking the question. The answer we get back is that insurance companies are not heavily invested in subprime mortgage-backed bonds. We all read about what's going on with Citibank and Merrill Lynch and some of the bigger brokerage houses in New York. They've made some really bad decisions, and many of them are having to be recapitalized. That's a kind of a different league than what we operate here in community banks in Minnesota. So I would say that we're on top of the problem, and we're not expecting any huge surprises. Keep in mind that banks are privately owned companies that are funded by shareholders. On occasion, they will make some bad decisions, and they deserve to fail. And our job is to mitigate the fallout to the consumers. One company that you probably have read about in the newspaper is a company called MoneyGram, which is a licensed money transmitter. They send money from this country to Mexico and Africa and places like that. MoneyGram invested a huge amount of money in subprime mortgage loans, did severe financial damage to the company, and they're now now in the process of negotiating a rescue from a lot of money from companies in Wall Street. So I guess we'll probably continue to see some stress, but I believe it's manageable, and our job is to try to mitigate the fallout from these things, and to the extent possible to avoid failure, but it's not always possible to do that.
Can I follow up with one more?
Representative Gaines.
You mentioned credit unions, and I don't think you have jurisdiction over them. Am I correct about that?
Commissioner Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we do indeed have jurisdiction over credit unions.
Will you make some observations about credit unions? You made some observations then about banks. Will you do the same thing about credit unions?
Commissioner Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there, I think there are about 96 or 97 state-chartered credit unions. They tend to be a little bit smaller than the banks. The biggest state bank, I believe, is about $1.5 billion in assets, and I think the biggest state credit union is around $400 million. We have a fair number of very small credit unions that are literally operated out of a shoebox, and when the current bookkeeper passes on to the next world, they'll be merged with another one. So they tend to be a little bit smaller, and for the most part, they're not involved in business lending to the same extent that banks are. They're probably not as aggressive. I think one of the credit union people explained to me when I first came to work at the state, and I had a lot of experience with bank regulation, but not a lot of credit union experience regulation. And they said credit unions are a lot like banks, but they're not always trying to sell the customer something that he or she doesn't need. whether that's true or not is up for grabs. But I'm not aware that we've had a big increase in the number of troubled credit unions. I think we have a handful that we're continuing to get after. But it's a smaller number than in the banking world.
Thank you.
Commissioner, as I'm sure you're aware, the legislature recently had a report from the legislative auditor regarding the reporting and oversight of HMOs. And I believe the Department of Commerce has a role in that. Could you describe for the committee what the Commerce Committee or Department's role is, and how your investigations and oversight, how that stands currently.
Yes, Mr. HMOs are actually chartered and regulated by the Department of Health, but several years back, and it's been probably 7 or 8 years, the Health Department and the Commerce Department sat down and we figured out that our people that examine and regulate insurance companies probably are better suited to be doing the financial oversight of HMOs than the people at the Health Department. They had a very small staff, and we have a bigger staff, and we're up to date on all the latest technology. So we signed an agreement with the Health Department where we would do the financial monitoring and the financial examinations of HMOs on their behalf. So we're really a hired gun for the Health Department. And we examine them, I think it's every 3 years, for solvency. One of the issues in the legislative auditor's report was there's a lot of concern about how much HMOs are spending and things like that. And our charge is to monitor and assess the overall solvency of those entities, but not to try to second-guess management and how they spend their money. I guess the challenge to trying to review and monitor administrative expenses, the challenge would be using what yardstick. We'd end up in arguments that would never end with management about whether they should have had this seminar or this retreat or whether they should have bought this computer or a different one. So we did object a little bit to the idea that we should be reviewing very specific programs and also reviewing the level of expenditures beyond assessing their overall solvency.
So was your feeling that didn't need to be done, or that it simply was not the role of the Commerce Department?
Mr. Chairman, for one thing, it's not in our agreement with the Department of Health. We never agreed to do that. And the other, I think it would be very, very difficult, absent a yardstick, to review expenditures by what's basically a private sector company. I mean, it probably, obviously, needs some oversight, but to have a government agency second-guessing management on money that they spend would be very, very challenging and, in my opinion, very arbitrary, absent more guidance from you people.
Well, in order to examine how it was spent, then to simply report on that wouldn't necessarily be implying that it shouldn't have been spent in that way. I mean, isn't there a difference between second guessing and simply transparency?
Mr. Chairman, I think if you are seeking transparency, I don't know that you'd need the Commerce Department in the middle of that process. I think you could require maybe more disclosure from the HMOs without anybody second-guessing levels of expenditures.
There are other questions for the Department of Commerce? We still want to squeeze in a report from admin regarding Representative Welty's program. So if there are no further questions at this time, gentlemen, thank you very much. Mr. Rhodes, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Rhodes from the Department of Administration. I have with me Dave Fielding, who is the Director of Plant Management that put together the report, and he would like to go over the report with you, and if we can just kind of go through the whole thing before you have questions, it'd make it, because I think the floor would work a little better and faster.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you should have a copy of this report before you, and I won't recite it verbatim, but I'll see if I can just touch the high points for you. Throughout the course of the last legislative session, we worked closely with Representative Welty in the progress of what began as House File 295. There was a companion bill in the Senate, 1090. It was subsequently rolled into, I've got the number in front of me, 1392 in February, which was the Omnibus Finance Bill. And throughout the course of the development of the language of this bill, we tried to make it very clear that a program as the one that was being proposed, which involves documentation of potential energy savings, actual documentation, and more importantly, the payout of some kind of cash incentive, was going to ultimately require a pretty significant financial commitment, which was yet to be determined. And so the language that we were proposing was requesting that we take a step backwards and use the calendar year 2007 to do a more detailed evaluation of what such a program might look like, what the costs would be, and then we could come back and make a full report on that and a recommendation. At the end of the session, the language that was adopted ultimately did not preclude the requirement to do a statewide employee suggestion program with a requirement for cash incentives. So following the passing of the legislation in May, we then began to investigate where we might find sources of funds that would be necessary for us to build the staff support that would be required, the software support that would be required for statewide implementation, and also the source for the funds that would be used to pay out any cash incentives. I should back up just a moment, though, and point out that Representative Welty was kind enough to get us in touch with the folks from IBM who have a worldwide online employee suggestion program, and we followed through with them in late April on that. What we learned from it is it's a very impressive program, but it also has a pretty impressive cost structure associated with it in terms of proprietary software, maintenance of that software, and that each of their operating departments actually budget for the cost of administration, the cost for incentive payouts. And it was because of that learning and the sense that we all had that this was going to cost some money that we used to try to strike the language that I mentioned earlier. Nevertheless, this was adopted, and we went forward on advice from the Department of Finance. We found that there were two stumbling blocks to implementation of the program as passed. First of all, the program required the Commissioner of Administration to implement this program on a statewide basis, and under Minnesota Statute 16C, 16B.24, the Commissioner's authorization for maintenance and operation and access to funds is limited by statute to the State Capitol building grounds, other buildings in the Capitol area, Department of Public Safety, and a maintenance facility that we have down at Grove Street. Second problem that we encountered is that even within those buildings, the funds that are provided from the General Services Revolving Fund are to be used exclusively for the maintenance, operation, and upkeep of the buildings and grounds. And so because of those two findings, we really had no way of accessing the funds that would be necessary
to move forward on the program as defined by the legislation last year. Now, I do want to point out, however, that we haven't been idle during the time since May, and I've outlined in this report for you the kinds of things that, at least within the Department of Plant Management, which has responsibility here at the Capitol, that we've been doing, which is pretty widespread and pretty aggressive in terms of what we've been able to accomplish. I won't take time to go through those, but I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have on this. On a statewide basis, though, I do want to call your attention to the fact that we do have an employee suggestion process in place through our Saving Energy website. There is a specific email address that we use to have employees forward suggestions, and I've included a series of those suggestions here just to give you an idea of the kinds of recommendations that we've been receiving. So with that, I think rather crisply going through it, I'll turn it back to the committee for any questions that you may have.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And recognizing that we're on a little tight timetable tonight, I have a number of questions for you, and I suspect that perhaps some of these can also be asked this coming Friday when we're having another committee meeting on recycling solid waste and energy committee that's been meeting, and also with the Rules Committee. But I'm wondering just specifically at this point if you can answer on some of these examples of suggestions. Have any of them been implemented that you've received? And that's probably what's forthcoming in your other report as well, which I'm looking forward to. So I'm just wondering what you did.
Representative
that.
Taylor, Chair, and members of the committee, we have, in fact, and I'll just give you a couple of highlights. On the first page, second bullet from the bottom about requiring all equipment to be turned off when not in use, that really has been the genesis for us to move forward on something that I've outlined in more detail at the top of the page, which is the Personal Computer Energy Reduction Initiative. We began that in plant management just as a beta test to confirm that it could be done, that you know, so much of the after-hours running of computers is a function of the IT staff wanting to do updates to programs when people aren't at work. But we found ways to facilitate that and still be able to ensure that when folks go home at night or certainly on the weekends, the computers and monitors are shut off. Once we confirmed that worked and worked well, we then approached the OET, and which has broader statewide responsibility, and that's what's outlined here, that rolling that out across the state through OET is underway now. Each operating agency is going to have their own set of final conclusions as to how they need to operate, but the expectation is that all of those will be implemented by May of this year. That being one example. On the second page, where we talk about have no more hot water for faucets except for cafeterias, what that has led to is the recognition that, again, like computers, there's a fair amount of time in the course of a week when there's no one in the buildings when hot water is needed, and so timers are being added to ensure that that we shut those operations down when they're not required. I do want to point out another bullet here about replacing all regular light bulbs in state facilities. At least here on the Capitol campus, we are exclusively in fluorescents now, compact fluorescents, with the exception of, I'm talking about the bulbs that we maintain. There may be the others, but with the exception of the Capitol building itself, and that becomes a historical society a call. So those are just some quick examples, and I can certainly give you others.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And I, in recognition of the fact that we have a deadline, I have many more questions, but as I said before, I'm looking forward to the report on Friday, and perhaps the committee might be interested in the results of that at a later time, but not right now. So thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman,
thank you.
If you'd
Mr.
like,
Rose.
we would be happy to sit down with you and kind of go over in much more detail. We could talk to you about our recycling. We're talking about trying to get the house to use the recycled paper for all the paper you go through. But the issues of making sure it works through the copy machine are they don't want to get jammed up during session, so they want to make sure we do a test run during session. So those are the kinds of things we should probably talk to you about offline.
Well, gentlemen, the last conversation that I had with you about this, I think we were discussing the possibility of changing the legislation to better correspond with what in fact is possible and doesn't run afoul of other constraints. And I think you've had those conversations with Representative Welty as well. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess to the two testifiers, Mr. Rhodes and Mr. Fielding, we had a discussion in my office about the report that came forward, and we talked about how you had some concerns about the legislation that was passed and how you couldn't work with it, but then I also asked you if you had come up with any recommendations whatsoever about how we could implement an employee incentive program, and besides what you're currently doing, there was no recommendation whatsoever. And so we had a follow-up conversation about how could we work this out, and the comment was what was made that maybe you could call in some retired employees to possibly look into this, and I didn't receive any follow-up conversation on that. So I'm just wondering, one, did you ever follow up and consult the retired employees, and then secondly, did you come up with any sort of suggestion for an implementation program that could work?
Representative Welty, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we did, in fact, rather than being retired employees, the organization is, the acronym is RETAP, which is Retired Engineers Technical Assistance Program. They are, in fact, engaged in a study of this building right now, independent of all the work that we've done. We did approach them, Representative Welty, and the initial response from them was that they did not feel that they had the expertise to work in this area. I asked them to go back and canvass their membership a second time just to be absolutely sure, and I'm waiting on that response. Now, as far as the recommendations for an incentive program, the fundamental problem here is suggestion programs are fine, but the minute we get into the distribution of an incentive, anything that has cash value, it opens up an enormous amount of complication, irrespective of how many zeros there are on the incentive. And so, quite frankly, without funding and without access to funds, I'm at a loss to know how I can create an incentive program without the funding to do so. If others have suggestions, I'm certainly happy to sit down and talk about it. But that's been our conclusion up to this point.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, one thing we want to do is if we're going to do it, let's do it so it works. Let's not do it so it becomes a cumbersome thing that doesn't work. If we want it to be successful, we should have an operation that would get us that success.
Well, gentlemen, obviously, I think everyone is in agreement with that, and I think that we do need to have some ongoing discussions about this. I wish we had made more progress to this point, but we're not going to make any more today because we're well over our time. We're supposed to be in the caucus, and hopefully we can continue this discussion later. I invite you to do that, and this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.